From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire Health and Human Services Commissioner Jeffrey Myers is back with us today, and although his agency covers a wide range of issues, we'll focus on four: the state's opioid crisis, mental health system, child protection programs, and Medicaid expansion. And of course, folded into all of these is the ongoing debate over how to pay for them. So that's what we'll cover this hour, and let's get your questions in for the commissioner. If you interacted with the department in one of these areas, let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Commissioner Myers, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with opioid addiction, because it seems that crisis is feeding so many other problems in the state, like the child protection system and so forth. And we've been asking this question for a while now, Commissioner Myers. I'd love to get your take on it, about why New Hampshire has been so particularly hard hit by this. An often cited statistic is that we're third in the nation in terms of per capita opioid-related deaths. Why do you think that is, Commissioner Myers? Why New Hampshire?
Well, this is an issue that I faced from the first day that I became commissioner. I assumed office in January of 16, and as I was transitioning into office, obviously the opioid crisis was really, it had been developing for some time. I don't know if it was on everybody's radar. There were certainly signs that people were starting to see, but it really emerged in such a tremendous way at that time. And so I've been focused on it from the beginning of my tenure. As to your question about why New Hampshire, I think there's a combination of factors that come into play. And it's not just New Hampshire. There are other states that have similar overdose rates and overdose death rates. But you're right, New Hampshire is high on that list. The rate of prescription drugs, of opioid prescriptions in New Hampshire, I think was very high. The science and the analysis that have been going on this issue over the last couple of years, I think, is showing that there was a transition among a lot of people from pain pills and medications that they were receiving for conditions. And when they were unable to access those prescriptions in the same way, they were transitioning over to heroin, and then that became fentanyl. And what we all know is that fentanyl is produced sometimes in crock pots. There's no quality control. Someone who uses drugs like that never knows what they're getting. And that has obviously led to a very, very serious situation.
Well, and that's a scenario that we hear about in other states. I mean, certainly, as you said, other states have this opioid problem. But it just always strikes me that, on the face of it, New Hampshire is a lovely place. It's relatively high per capita income.
Right.
People in general, I mean, there's problems with access to health care, but in general, we have decent rates of health insurance coverage. So we're well-educated. We're relatively well-off. So it just always strikes me as odd that we would have such a problem with
this. And this crisis has struck every economic strata in our state. It's not just among people of poverty. It's not among people of wealth. It is really just hit across the board, and there's too many stories. The state is obviously trying to do its part along, I think, with the medical community and many others. We are putting, increasing amounts of money into prevention, treatment, and recovery services. This year alone, this fiscal year that we're in now, I've brought almost $25 million in contracts to the Governor and Council for prevention, treatment, and recovery services. Those are monies that are generated from the Governor's Commission on Alcohol Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, as well as the Cures Act money that we got from the federal government, and the appropriation that the legislature gives to the department for our Bureau of Drug and Alcohol Services. So that's really the non-Medicaid piece. In addition to that, there's Medicaid expansion and our Medicaid program. So starting in July of 2016, we had a full substance use disorder benefit in the standard Medicaid program, as well as a benefit in the Medicaid expansion program.
So treatment has expanded greatly, and that's often a factor cited in this opioid-related crisis, why it hit New Hampshire so hard. People have said, look, we had a pretty thin system of drug treatment in place, so maybe that's why we've been hit especially hard.
Yeah, and we're responding. You know, I looked at some data the other day. We now have about 300 residential SUD treatment beds in the state now.
SUD is?
Substance use disorder, excuse me. So we've got about 300 of residential. That's just inpatient kind of residential bed. Now, that's not hospital-based. That's kind of provider-based. So that capacity is increasing. And that's one of the reasons, Laura, the emergence of this opioid issue was one of the reasons why the department and I, before I became commissioner, as a director in the department, was pursuing, you know, behavioral health transformation waiver at CMS. We have this $150 million waiver that is for behavioral health in New Hampshire. We've set up 7 integrated delivery networks of both medical providers and social service providers in various regions across the state. And there's about $30 million a year going into mental health and substance use disorder treatment services above and beyond the sources that I just mentioned and above and beyond the standard Medicaid program. So this is a program that was really intended to utilize that money to build capacity.
Well, lots of money.
To retain workforce, to attract workforce, to create electronic health records across the system, and to really facilitate services and particularly increased capacity for both mental health and for substance use disorders.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you about mental health, Commissioner Myers, because that's, you know, you really can't separate the two in many cases. But I'm hearing you talk about this expanded capacity, and New Hampshire's had to ramp up this, you know, beefier treatment system pretty quickly to respond. But we also hear about treatment facilities closing down. Hope for New Hampshire Recovery has, you know, closed down and then is going to set up shop again in most of its former communities, but not Concord. Also Serenity Place in Manchester. So are we expanding too quickly? Are we not paying close enough attention as we just try to open doors and cross our fingers that it goes okay?
Well, I don't think we had the luxury, as a state now, just speaking as a state, I don't think we had the luxury of time. This crisis was hitting in a big way, and there certainly was a need to address the issue as quickly as possible. So, yes, there are new, younger organizations that were being stood up in order to respond. Hope for Recovery New Hampshire was one of those organizations. Serenity Place was another organization. We're obviously trying to build their capacity to provide these services. In the case of Hope, they were operating 5 locations. They felt that they could only operate 3. We got them some extra funding so that they could continue in Franklin and in Berlin, as well as Manchester. I've been working with a local group in Claremont, a group of providers which Hope had operated in Claremont. And so we're going to be standing up new recovery services in Claremont. And the department is talking to several providers who have expressed interest in the Concord area as well. So at the end of the day, I think that the services that Hope had been providing in all those 5 communities are going to be able to be sustained. Your broader question about, you know, how are these organizations managing? Can they really respond?
And vetted. Are we keeping an eye on them?
We are. I mean, we have contracts in place. We have a program integrity office at the department.
Is that new? A program integrity office?
Well, there's been a program integrity component of the department. We're required to have that as part of our Medicaid program overall. But as commissioner, I've expanded that office greatly and put more resources into it. And so we are working with the Charitable Trust Division at the Attorney General's office and other state resources so that we can keep track of these organizations. We're asking for financials. You may recall that a few months ago, I announced that we were going to be doing financial audits of all of our SUD treatment providers to ensure that we are tracking how they're doing. These are not gotcha audits. We want to take a look at how they're operating to ensure that they have the resources, the staff, the credentialing, that they're operating in the best possible way, and that they will utilize public funds appropriately. And our expectation is, when so utilized, that they're going to help improve outcomes. I mean, they're going to deliver services that will help address the crisis out there.
So it sounds like you have recently, Commissioner Myers, amped up your efforts to expand oversight given the problems that we've seen.
Absolutely. We are doing audits of all the 20 or so treatment organizations. Those audits are being released. Hope for Recovery New Hampshire was released. There's a second audit that's about to be released very shortly of another organization, and we're going to continue releasing those audits as they're completed.
Have you had to hire more staff to do that or what?
Well, I appointed a new director of the Office of Program Integrity and Planning, and we have added some staff, and I'm obviously looking at that in terms of our next budget. As you know, the legislative session is about to wind down, and then over the summer, the department, as well as all other state departments, are going to start focusing on planning their next budget. I have to file my what's called an efficiency budget, but it's our agency budget, with the Department of Administrative Services by October 1st of this year. So, you know, after the legislature goes home in a month or so, and after everybody takes a deep breath for a couple of weeks, we're going to get to work seriously on our next budget.
Well, and you mentioned the communities where Hope for New Hampshire Recovery closed down and then got reopened.
Right.
Where are the gaps now, Commissioner Myers? You mentioned Concord, for example. Where are the big gaps in our treatment infrastructure here in the state?
In terms of behavioral health overall, I think there's a couple of areas that we're looking at. I mean, we do want to expand recovery services in Concord, and as I said, we're talking to some providers who would be able to do that. There are mental health gaps as well. If you look at those waiting in hospital emergency rooms, particularly in Concord and Manchester and Nashua, those are the three, not that other communities are not hit, they are, but those are the three where I think most people are concentrated. A lot of people, I mean, I know for a fact that there are folks who drive people down to the Concord ER thinking that if they get someone who is experiencing a mental health crisis to the Concord Hospital, that that's a quicker entrance into New Hampshire Hospital. And so Concord acts as a magnet. That's one of the reasons why one of our mobile crisis teams is located in Concord as well. So a mobile crisis team is a group of medical professionals, a psychiatrist, workers. It has apartments associated with it so that people can be treated in the community to divert them away from the emergency room itself, and then hopefully stabilize folks, get them connected back to community resources, and so that they can go back to the community without having to wait at the hospital and without having to go to New Hampshire Hospital if that's avoidable.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you about mental health.
Sure.
We've done so many programs on the mental health system, the lawsuit, the follow-up changes that have been made. But I also want to invite our listeners to join us, Commissioner Myers. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. It's an update on all the work at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services with the agency's Commissioner Jeffrey Myers. He oversees some of the state's most challenging issues, as we're hearing, the opioid crisis and a struggling treatment network, plus efforts to greatly expand that network of treatment. We've talked about that. We're also going to cover mental health treatment and the child protection system here in the state. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Commissioner Myers, before we transition to mental health,
sure.
I did want to ask you one more question about the opioid crisis, and that's prevention. We did a show a couple weeks ago where our guest said, look, treatment, obviously you have to do that if someone is in the throes of addiction, but we have not focused enough on prevention, and we don't really know the right way to do it beyond, drugs are bad, don't touch them, kids.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Prevention is really where it is. And we've got to reach the younger generation. And, I've been working with the governor for quite some time now in order to help direct some of the funding that comes through the Governor's Commission as well as our BDES funding, and in the expectation that we're going to get more federal funding soon. And I want to touch on that for just a minute. we really need to focus more on prevention. We are funding prevention programs. We funded a prevention program just a few months ago at Timberland High School that is putting professionals in the school, really reaching out to kids, really trying to educate the kids. We need to be doing more of that. And that's something, again, that I think you'll see increasing resources. I want to address the federal funding issue just for a minute. There's been a lot of talk about that publicly in terms of New Hampshire getting its rightful share.
Given in terms of opioid treatment.
Exactly. Yeah. Given the high overdose death rate and so forth that the CDC has found here. So we know that we're going to be getting additional Cures Act money. Hopefully that's going to be announced very soon. That will be at least $3 million, which is what it was last year. And then in addition to that, the bill that the president signed a few weeks ago, the appropriations bill, earmarks about $145 million for the states that are hardest hit. So sitting here today, I don't know exactly how much we're going to get out of that pot, but that pot of $145 million, which may not be enough, but it's certainly more than we've had before, will go to states like New Hampshire and other states, you know, who have experienced a very high overdose death rate to address the crisis. So we believe that we're hopefully on the cusp of getting an injection of federal funds that will make a difference, not only for treatment, but also for prevention and recovery services.
Because that formula previously did not work in New Hampshire's
favor.
Right.
It was based on a per capita population as opposed to the impact of the actual crisis.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Commissioner Myers, you touched on it, so let's go there. The state's mental health system. Yep. First of all, just broadly, what is the connection between the longstanding struggles of the state's mental health system and the drug addiction crisis that we've been talking about?
Well, you know, one of the most kind of seeable connections is the fact that there are so many individuals out there who have co-occurring disorders, that they have a substance use disorder as well as a mental health illness as well. And so the system has to work together. We can't just bifurcate it. There can't be a mental health system over here and a substance use disorder system over there.
Because when people have mental health issues, they often self-medicate, including substance use.
And there's so many people who are presenting in our hospital emergency rooms who do have mental health conditions, but they also have a substance use disorder condition. Look at the state prison population. You know, I think Commissioner Wren and now Commissioner Hanks have talked eloquently about the fact that about 80 or maybe even more than 80% of the people coming into the state men's prison, you know, have either a mental health issue or substance use issue or both. And so it's really, it's prevalent. And so our response obviously has to be integrated. That's one of the reasons, one of the first things that I did, one of the first changes I made organizationally at the department was to create a division of behavioral health. Because previously, the Bureau of Drug and Alcohol Services was in one part of the department, and mental health was in another part of the department, and children's behavioral health was actually through DCYF. And so I took all those pieces and put them together and appointed a director so that we could have an integrated approach to how we dealt with behavioral health. And that was obviously the point of our Medicaid waiver that I referred to earlier.
Because it's all related in the human body and the human
Absolutely.
Spirit and the human condition. So
Absolutely.
To separate them seems silly.
Right. And if we're going to address everything, we've got to not only bring the people in the department, the programs in the department together, we've got to bring the funding streams together so that they can work together to address the issue.
Well, coming up, I want to drill into the plight of Granite Staters in a mental health crisis. Going to the emergency room, waiting there, that's been a big issue. There have been lawsuits around this. And according to our reporters anyway, still unresolved, still people waiting in crisis in ERs around the state. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-892-6477.
Is Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the head of Health and Human Services, Jeffrey Myers, is with us, updating us on the opioid crisis, the mental health system, and other challenges facing his department. Send us your email to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're focusing in on four topics with the commissioner today: the state's opioid crisis, the mental health system, child protection programs, and Medicaid expansion. So again, you can give us a call or send us an email, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Commissioner Myers, let's go to the phones. Rick is joining us from Ossipee. Hi, Rick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Good
morning.
Thank you, Commissioner, for taking my phone call. My question to you has to do with the first 5 days of detox. One of the issues that I work at White Horse Addiction Center in Center Ossipee, and we are always challenged by how to get someone detoxed. And if they're taken to a local hospital, basically the hospital will look at them for a few hours and send them home. And I'm told by the local hospitals that their contract or their license prohibits them from actually doing detox in a local hospital. And you know, the doctors were part of this problem. I'm not saying they're all of it. They're a small part of the problem of getting people addicted in the first place. And it seems like the places where in rural areas where the doctors are located is at the hospital. And where we need the help is in the first 5 days of somebody's recovery is getting them into detox and then out of detox into a 28-day program. And so one of the things that I when the governor was at White Horse for our annual banquet, I spoke to him and also to Marty Bolden about this. If we could have an exception for local hospitals that they could detox people for the first 5 days, if they're working with a clinic like ours, and we refer someone to the hospital, they would take care of the first 5 days, and then we would arrange to have them go straight from the hospital into a 28-day program. That would maximize the effectiveness of the 28-day program because the person would be ready for it when they left there.
Sure, and they're there in front of you, so why not manage it right then and there? Go ahead, Commissioner Myers. Thank you so much, Rick.
So, Rick, thank you so much for your question. So I agree. I mean, we need to ensure that we have adequate detox. There are issues in parts of the state in terms of resources. You know, one of the ways that we're trying to address that is that the governor and I have just submitted to the federal government a separate waiver request for a waiver of the so-called IMD requirement. And to really just break it down for you and everybody else listening is that right now there's a federal prohibition on reimbursement for certain substance use disorder services, including detox, if it's in a facility that's got more than 16 beds.
I see. And so the hospitals won't get reimbursed for doing that work that Rick suggests.
Yeah, because most of them are exactly. And so one of the things we're trying to do with this waiver, and we believe it will be approved, the federal government has approved several waivers in other states already, and they very much encourage us to apply for this waiver as well, is we're going to open up a reimbursement monies for these services.
Because as Rick points out, people are right there. They're in front of you. Why not?
Exactly. And that may not address fully Rick's point about how the licensing works, and that's something we probably need to take a greater look at in combination with the licensing boards as well. But we need to ensure that we've got adequate detox services. I think this waiver that we're going to get is going to help that financially to a great extent, and then we obviously have to look at the licensing issues.
Well, it's interesting, and I'd not heard about that waiver.
That was
effort.
Just filed about a week ago.
Okay.
And we haven't publicized it heavily, but the governor has submitted it under a letter that he wrote, and it's going to go through a federal comment period. But we think within a few months we'll have that in place, and that will open up, I think, a funding stream for a number of these services, including detox services.
So you and Rick have been talking about detox services at hospitals. In terms
right.
of mental health, Commissioner Myers,
yes.
and you know this, private hospitals used to have psychiatric units that they have closed. And some say this is also part of the problem with people waiting now in mental health crisis, in emergency rooms, that, you know, hospitals, if they complain about their ERs being taken up by people with mental health problems, maybe they shouldn't have closed their psychiatric units. I wonder what you think about that, that hospitals really need to play more of a role in the solution to this ER mental health problem.
Yeah, I think I do feel that way. I feel, firstly, that the reason that we are in the situation we're in with people waiting every day, and I want to say at the outset that any day that any one person is waiting is too much. And the fact that we have 30 and 40 people, adults, predominantly waiting, is not something that's acceptable to me. It's something that I've been working on again from the beginning of my tenure. There are hospitals that close some voluntary wings. There are other hospitals, however, that have added designated receiving facility beds. In other words, that they've set aside beds. They've taken on the responsibility of running a number of beds for the involuntary admission of people who are waiting at hospitals. And so they've expanded some capacity. Look, Laura, I think at the end of the day, the reason that so many people are waiting is a combination of a number of factors. And to the extent that there were some closure of some voluntary beds, that may be a contributing factor. But there were other community resources that were there as well earlier. There were transitional beds that went away because the funding wasn't there. And that's something that the governor and the legislature and the department have worked together on over the last year or so. We added 20 new transitional beds last fiscal year in fiscal year 17. There's an RFP that's already gone out for 20 new beds for this year. We repurposed some money that we had and one of the bills passed last year to bring on some more transitional beds.
And where are those beds that you're talking
well,
about?
Well, some of them are located in the southern part of the state. The RFP that's just gone out for
it's
the new 20
proposals.
Beds
yeah.
are going to be in other parts of the state, including up north, including in the Lakes region.
So we're not talking about the state hospital here in Concord.
No. These are new community resources so that and why this is important is that it addresses what I refer to as kind of the back door of New Hampshire Hospital. So we know we have a problem of people waiting to get in, but we can't let people in if there are people who are at New Hampshire Hospital who don't need to be treated medically any longer but don't have a place to go. I mean, as we sit here today, there are about 20 people at New Hampshire Hospital who are homeless, and we're not going to discharge them to the street. That's not what we do. And so they're there until we can solve the housing problem. Many of these folks don't have family. They don't have other resources they can go to. So Lori Chibinette, who's the CEO of New Hampshire Hospital, the new CEO of New Hampshire Hospital, who I appointed, and I and the governor's office and many other people have been meeting to really try to address the discharge issue. And part of that, a critical part of that, is having housing options in the community. So we need some permanent housing solutions. The transitional housing is also very important because
that's
people
tough,
then
though.
Can step down from New Hampshire Hospital to transitional housing in the community with supports and then be connected to resources in the community. And when we do that, then beds will open up in New Hampshire Hospital for us to be able to take people off a waiting list.
So two quick questions. First of all, the housing, you guys, you and the governor have your goal at the state level, but then when it gets down to the community level, we've seen communities say, I don't want that, you know, housing unit next to me. I think in Keene, the drug treatment facility was just rejected, for example. So, you know, placing these homes, beds, whatever you want to call them, is difficult at the local level.
Well, we've been successful so far. So we have a contract with Harbor Homes for transitional beds in the southern part of the state. Harbor Homes is a federally qualified health center. It's called the Partnership for Successful Living. Peter Kelleher is the CEO of that organization. They've been an invaluable partner. We've worked with NFI North, Paul Dan at NFI. They are running some of our transitional beds. There are other providers that are out there. Again, we've got this RFP out there now, so we're hoping to get bids on 20 more beds. That's really critical because that will help us address, as I said, the back door.
So, Commissioner Myers, what's the goal in terms of this people in a mental health crisis waiting in the emergency room? At NHPR's last reporting, 42 adults and 10 children. You know, we've been talking about this for years. Is the goal zero?
Yes, the goal has to. I mean, there a number of years ago, people didn't wait. And they didn't wait because the capacity of New Hampshire Hospital was a lot higher. We only have 164 beds at New Hampshire Hospital now. It's the only state-run facility. Of the 164 beds, 24 are children's beds. Now, we've been able to reduce the number of kids waiting. On most days, we have an arrangement with Hampstead Hospital in the southern part of the state. They have a children's unit. We have a contract now with Hampstead. They take kids with insurance, and then we can supplement that under our contract for kids who may not have insurance. So, you know, that's been a success. So I think we've reduced the number of kids waiting. It's a general matter. But we clearly have a problem with the back door. There are patients who don't need the services day to day, the intensive psychiatric services at New Hampshire Hospital, but they're there because there's some barrier to their discharge.
Well,
and that's what we, and I think if we really solve
homelessness
that,
or whatever,
exactly, then I think we can greatly reduce the number of people who are waiting.
All right. Well, Commissioner Myers, I want to share you with the listeners. Lots of questions
sure.
are coming in. And here's one from Kermit, who says, if so many persons with co-occurring mental health disorders with substance abuse is such a big problem, why are there no substance abuse services offered to clients of New Hampshire Hospital while they are patients in the state hospital? My son has been admitted many times to New Hampshire Hospital for episodes brought on by substance abuse and never gets drug treatment while he is there. We've been told the legislature does not allow drug treatment at the state hospital. When will the state hospital offer detox and drug treatment referral to drug rehab programs? Great question, Kermit. Thank you so much. And I'm very sorry to hear about your son.
Kermit, I'm sorry to hear about that as well. I will tell you, again, that refers back to the issue I was discussing
the
earlier.
The siloing.
Is that, no, it's the size of the New Hampshire Hospital. It has more than 16 beds. So there's no federal reimbursement. There's a lack of funding for substance use treatment until we get this waiver. So when the waiver is gotten, then there'll be a funding stream that will help defray the cost of providing those services. New Hampshire Hospital obviously focuses on mental health issues, psychiatric services, but there are some SUD services that we'll be able to offer and provide once this new waiver is approved.
Okay. Well, so Kermit, stay tuned. And again, good luck with your son. And let's go back to our callers. John is joining us from New Durham. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. How are you doing?
Fine.
Commissioner Meyer.
Good morning, John.
We haven't spoken in 18 months. You and I had a conversation when my son was waiting. Can you recite the numbers for me that are waiting today?
At New Hampshire Hospital, John?
Yeah. Going into New Hampshire Hospital.
Okay.
You were saying 20 people, and I think the numbers the last I heard recited by Ken were probably 50 in the adults, somewhere around 50 in the adults and 10 in the children.
Well, I know. So, John, thank you for calling. I didn't look at the numbers this morning before coming to the studio. I looked at yesterday's numbers, and I think and they vary because the numbers in the I get a report twice a day. So at the beginning of the day at New Hampshire Hospital, I get a report from staff there as to who's waiting in all the emergency departments across the state. And then obviously we're working with New Hampshire Hospital and those hospitals during the day to try to discharge folks appropriately from New Hampshire Hospital when we can discharge them and then bring people off that waiting list. So the numbers are going to, they sometimes vary, they often vary between the morning and the afternoon. As of yesterday morning, I believe there were, it was in the low 40s of adults.
Okay, so John, did you have a personal story to this, personal experience? It sounds like you do.
Well, I've shared that with you before, Laura. My son has been waiting, and it was, you know, over 2 weeks. He was in the numbers of, 50, and it was, you know, over 2 weeks of waiting. This was 18 months ago.
Where did he wait, John? Just remind me.
Over in Frisbee Memorial Hospital. Mm.
So he was waiting in the emergency room in a mental health crisis 2 weeks. That sounds like it would only make it worse.
And it does. It only makes it worse. It really doesn't help the situation. And the unfortunate part is I don't see, and I used to think the back door was the issue too, Commissioner, because having had my son spend 4 months in the facility, New Hampshire Hospital, and getting the treatment he needed, and they did a fantastic job. Dr. Desnera and the team over there, Ms. Chibinette, though she wasn't there at the time,
yep.
And has replaced the now departed CEO. The hospital has done a great job, and he's doing very well.
But so glad to hear that, John. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Laura. But the numbers don't seem to be coming down.
Well, and that's a question I would love to get at you with, Commissioner Myers.
Yep.
Again, you know, no matter what they are, 20, 30, 40, it's too many.
I don't disagree. It is too many. And that's why we're so focused. That's why we've undertaken a number of measures. Again, we've built out our mobile crisis teams. We're adding transitional beds to address the back door. We are engaged in a number of efforts to coordinate between the hospitals and New Hampshire Hospital to try to build up as many community resources as we can. We are, in fact, I'm going to be bringing a contract to the council very shortly to provide some additional money to the 10 community mental health centers across the state to beef up their assertive community treatment teams. So those are teams of doctors and other professionals that provide mental health services to people in the community. And the community mental health centers have struggled with workforce issues. So there's some money in my budget that was put there by the legislature last year that has started going out and will continue to go out to help them hopefully increase their ACT team workforce so that they can take on more patients in the community.
Well, here's an email that came in from someone who did not want their name used. We recently had a suicide attempt in our family by an adult suffering from major depression. The family member will receive 3 to 5 days hospitalization at an inpatient psychiatric unit at a nearby hospital, then will be discharged to their home where they live alone, and nearby family who work full-time fear another attempt will be made. Because this individual is not schizophrenic or bipolar, they would not qualify for a group home. This person asks, why don't we have supportive housing and or home visit services for individuals suffering from major depression in New Hampshire? Boy, this is a really compelling email, and my heart goes out to this person.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we do have peer support services. That was a requirement of the community mental health agreement, our settlement with the federal government. We've invested a number of resources, a lot of resources in that peer recovery program. So there are some resources out there and that are available to some folks in this situation. So hopefully there'll be a way to this person, if this family would call the department, we could follow up directly with them. But there are some resources out there for peer support.
Okay, that would be great. And again, to this person, thank you for the email. And Commissioner Myers, after a break, a lot more calls and emails from our listeners. And I also do want to ask you about the status of the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. New Hampshire's child protection system has been under intense scrutiny. So we'll talk about that after a break. Also look a little bit more about how the legislature wants to fund Medicaid expansion. Some questions around that funding mechanism. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Commissioner Jeffrey Myers. He's the head of New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. Tomorrow on our show, we'll look at the business of recycling. So if you've got questions or comments about that, you can send them now by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. For now, Jeffrey Myers is here. As I said, the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. And we'd love your questions and comments. And Commissioner Myers, lots of people who want to talk to you. So let's go right back to them. Eric is in Nashua. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Morning. Fine.
Good.
Good. Good. I had a question for Commissioner Jeffrey Myers. If a secure psychiatric unit is perceived as a legitimate mental health treatment facility, how was it that it is not recognized in the $30 million mental health settlement?
Well, good question. The secure psychiatric unit is at the state prison, is that
yes,
right, Commissioner
Myers? Yes, it's located
Myers?
At the state prison.
And
more,
lots of people getting mental health services there.
Yeah, there are. It is used for that purpose, and it's something obviously the state has been grappling with for some time. There's been a lot of concern about the status of the secure psychiatric unit. There's been legislators who have introduced bills that would potentially change how we the state manages that the population there, including the location at the prison as well, has been an issue that's been raised by folks.
And what is the issue with having it at the prison?
Well, that there are people that need psychiatric treatment and mental health treatment, and it's a correctional setting. I mean, that's the general issue that I think has been raised. But I think there are a lot of folks out there that on both sides that feel passionately about whether it should or should not be there. As to Eric's question about why that wasn't included in the plan. So I was not involved. I was not at the department at the time that the plan consent agreement with the federal government was negotiated. So I wasn't party to all those discussions. I'm not certain why it may not have been addressed at that time. But I think what the plaintiffs in that case, including the federal government and some of the advocacy groups, including the Disability Rights Center in New Hampshire, what they were focused on were the capacity for community mental health resources. And so that's what the settlement agreement really, that's what our community mental health agreement really focuses on, is building out capacity for those that are not involved necessarily in the correctional system.
Yeah. Well, given the number of people who are there, given that some of them, I think, have some pretty severe mental health issues, secure psychiatric units certainly conjures up images of people in trouble.
Well,
do you think it should be included in this broader mental health reform that the settlement calls for?
Well, the agreement is the agreement.
Sure.
And so, we are certainly addressing all of the requirements of the agreement. And I think overall, we've made tremendous progress in compliance with the agreement over the 4 years or so. We are now undertaking a new 10-year mental health plan. That is not going to take 10 years to do. I mean, we are working on it over the next number of months. It was part of House Bill 400 last year. I think that's, obviously it's one of the issues that will come up in the conversations, the focus groups, and I think in the discussions that the state is going to have with all stakeholders, including the legislature, about how we manage that population. For example, we know that there are folks that have been adjudicated as not guilty by reason of insanity. They're at New Hampshire Hospital today. When I became commissioner, I think there were 5 or 6 of those folks in beds there. Today, I think there are now 11. It's either 10 or 11. And so those are beds that potentially could be located somewhere else. And I think, I've talked to Commissioner Hanks. I've talked to the governor's office. There have been conversations with the legislature about looking at the justice-involved population, whether it's the forensic population at New Hampshire Hospital, whether it's the population of the secure psychiatric unit, and trying to figure out the best plan for the future.
Justice-involved means people with mental health issues who have committed crimes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Michael in North Conway. Hi, Michael. You're on the air with Commissioner Myers. Thank you so much for calling.
Good morning, Laura. It's good to be here.
Good.
I have a background in foster care. My wife and I have been licensed for foster care for a number of years. I've also done CASA work as well as parent aid work. And some observations that the agency just seems to be drowning in bureaucracy. more rules and regulations don't equal better service or care to the youth. And it just sort of, it bogs down the system. My wife is currently caring for an infant, and we're licensed for foster care, and she had to take more training. We've done this for many years. She had to take more training to deal with a newborn. It's just bureaucracy upon bureaucracy.
And when you say the agency, Michael, you mean Division of Children, Youth, and Families that runs the foster care program? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling, and thank you for the work that you do, because we desperately need more foster families. So go ahead, Commissioner Myers. The bureaucracy is discouraging for people who are committed, like our caller, and probably for people who might think about it, but then they look at the requirements and they go, oh, forget it.
Well, we don't want it to be discouraging. We want to be able to empower families to come forward and be foster families. It's obviously an important part of our child welfare system in New Hampshire. It's one of the reasons why the governor and the Senate, came forward with, I think it's Senate Bill 590, that has $1.1 million for additional foster care rates and other foster care support services. So, we know that we need to we don't want to perpetuate bureaucracy. On the other hand, we need to make sure that, we have safety in our system. And so there are certain things that we know that we have to do to ensure that the kids we place are placed in appropriate homes and that we know that they're going to be safe there. And that's not anything to say about Michael at all, but it's the reason why we have rules and regulations. We're trying to streamline them. We're trying to facilitate placement of kids. We just need to do so safely.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Lauren who says, what can they do to increase resources to ensure that post-foster adoptees have the mental health and physical health care that they require? So sounds like Lauren's talking about those kids who are adopted from the foster care system.
Yeah, exactly. And, we've got an effort undergoing that way. Senator Forrester, Jeannie Forrester, when she was in the Senate, sponsored a bill to establish a system of care for mental health for kids in New Hampshire. And it's a bill I very much supported. And we have a Children's Mental Health Bureau now at the department. And we are working to implement that system of care. And we are looking at how we can direct resources to kids, even when they're not in the child protection system. So that's something that we're actively working on. We hope to get some additional federal resources, and that's going to be part of the budget that I'm developing as well for the next biennial budget.
Well, Michael, thank you for the call. Lauren, for the Facebook comment. And since they both talked about foster care, let's talk about the broader system of child protective services, specifically the Division of Children, Youth, and Families, DCYF, as you know, has been under scrutiny for some time, especially after the deaths of two young children under its care. And then there was that independent report, Commissioner Myers, in 2016 that recommended major changes to this agency, not just in terms of funding, hiring more folks, overwhelmed caseworkers, everybody seemed to say was a big part of the problem. But there were other issues, too, the rules and regs around what these social workers could do. How far has DCYF come since this whole report came out?
I think we've made real progress, and surely there's more to be done. I'm not saying that there's not, but I think we've done a lot. We've, with respect to staffing, we've added about 40, since I've become commissioner, I think we've added about 40 assessment workers for child protection. There are 13 additional assessment workers that are in one of the Senate bills that's now sitting in the House. And we're certainly going to look at additional resources as well. But we've increased the number of assessment positions to 125 now statewide, which was, I think, a bit more than was targeted by the Jerry Milner's independent review. 115 of those are filled. And so I think that's a positive development. We've added family service workers. We have 92 now. So those family service workers basically help manage the case once a case is open. The assessment workers are they get referrals from central intake for the complaints, the allegations that are made, and they'll investigate the allegations. So if it becomes opened as a case, then the family service workers take over. There are 92 authorized positions right now. 87 of those are filled. The number of assessments coming in is coming down a little bit. The overdue assessments rate is coming down. I want to give credit to not only my own staff, which has worked so hard. I mean, these workers, you know, they volunteer to work overtime. They're being compensated for that as well. But they're putting in the hours. They're working very, very hard to get those overdue assessments down. They've done a very good job. We also have a contract with Child and Family Services that we entered into about 6 months ago.
That's almost a nonprofit. 6 months ago.
It's a nonprofit based in Manchester. Exactly. And so we've got, I think, about eight or so of their staff that have joined, are working in our facilities to help address some of the overdue assessments, certain aspects of those. That's been a huge help in bringing down those numbers. The average caseloads are still high, but the new assessment workers that we've added thus far, the new assessment workers that are contained in Senate Bill 590 and 592, along with, very importantly, along with the money for voluntary services. So,
and we should talk about those.
And I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. But I think we've made progress. I've also brought in new leadership, Chris Tappan, the associate commissioner, Joe Ripsom, who had been the deputy commissioner down in New Jersey for child welfare, moved with his family up to New Hampshire. My new deputy, Thomas Pristow, who has a child welfare background in several states as he's worked in. Everybody's working together, and we've got new leadership and a new direction. And frankly, you know, I think I'm thankful for the governor's support. He's been very supportive of adding resources at DCYF, the legislature, the leadership in both the House and the Senate, various senators and committees, very supportive of adding these resources. So the state is really working together in the way that it does best to address this issue.
So you're talking about resources, Commissioner Myers, and that was definitely a big, big issue in this report. But the other issue was there were regulations in place, put in place by the legislature, that social workers said sometimes tied their hands. You know, they had a suspicion, but they couldn't really report it.
It was the law.
Yeah.
And we've worked, you know, with Judge Kelly.
Has that changed?
I think it has. I think Judge Kelly has undertaken an effort as the chief administrative judge for the circuit court where these cases are heard. We've taken a look at the wording of the statute. The legislature has made some changes. And so I think there's really a clearer understanding about what the burden of proof is, what the judges expect. We're adding lawyers to our staff as well. One of the bills that I mentioned adds three DCYF attorneys to the 14 or 15 that we have today. That's going to be a very big help as well. But the point I want to make overall is that if we're going to have an effective and proactive child welfare system in New Hampshire, we've got to have resources, as the legislature and the governor have now recognized, on the front end, that before a family even comes into the DCYF system, we've got to have money, the so-called voluntary services, so that when there are allegations made and we take a look at those, but they don't really rise to the level of neglect and abuse, but there are signs or triggers that we want to be watch with a particular family, that there are resources to provide support for that family.
That gets the voluntary services
exactly,
as well.
So that they don't become part of the system.
Well, and that was part of the
problem. You've got to be proactive.
That was part of the problem that was mentioned in another child died this year, murder-suicide involving his father. And Moira O'Neill, the director of the Office of the Child Advocate, was in her job just a short time before issuing a preliminary finding that voluntary services, if they had been in place, might have helped. There were a couple cries for help from this dad, but it didn't rise to that earlier, tougher level of, oops, we should intervene, and the father and son died. So, you know, you're talking about voluntary services being put in place. But are there any other lessons learned from this case? The mom is threatening legal action, says DCYF could have been more active.
Yeah, I mean, I think because of potential legal action, I can't address the specifics of the case. But what I will say is that I think that's the point that's been recognized by everybody, by the legislature, by the governor, by the department. That's why we're working together to really put more into prevention programs at TCYF, to put more into voluntary services, to increase the capacity of our family resource centers. There are about 10 of them around the state. Some of this money that's being appropriated, hopefully this year, in the next few weeks, is going to go out to those family resource centers. We've got to build the overall system capacity and ability to provide resources and support for our families has to be increased. And that, I think, will go a long way in addressing what turned out to be a very tragic situation that you mentioned.
Commissioner Myers, I have to ask you about Medicaid expansion, something I know you've been watching very closely, and you've touched on it a couple times already this hour.
Yeah.
An expansion plan has passed the Senate, cleared a key House vote recently.
Yeah.
How confident are you, Commissioner Myers, in the way that this plan is financed? Because, as you know, there have been some major questions about the financial underpinnings of this, you know, yanking money from the alcohol fund.
Yeah, I want to talk about I want to address your question just a second. But what I want to say at the outset is this is certainly, you know, one of the highest priorities of my department, of many in the legislature, and so forth this year, of the governor as well, to ensure the continued health coverage of 52,000 low-income New Hampshire citizens. This program is playing just an incredible role at addressing people's health conditions that were not going addressed before. There are over, I think now, about 13,000 unique individuals who have gotten substance use disorder benefits. There are tens of thousands of individuals who are getting mental health benefits. There are, you know, like 98% or 99% of the people enrolled have a primary care doctor, some of them for the first time in their lives. So their chronic conditions, their medications are being addressed. This is making such a huge impact to the health outcomes and to the population health of this state that it's imperative that the bill work its way through the House Finance Committee and back onto the House floor and hopefully the final passage. Let me address the funding issue.
Yeah, quickly, and I do apologize. We're running out of time.
So I think we have we've come up with a sustainable program that will pass CMS muster. I've had a number of discussions. The governor and I have been to Washington a couple of times together, meeting with CMS about this. We are not relying on hospital donations in a way that raised issues before. What we are doing is we're accessing money that's derived from gross liquor profits in the state that gets put into the Alcohol Prevention and Treatment Fund. That's going to be raised for the first time to 5%. That's quite an achievement for everybody. And it's going to be fully funded. And so that 5% will pay the non-federal share. So the cost of services is a particular amount of money. The feds, starting in 2020, will pay 90% of that. So this alcohol funds will pay for that 10%. And we have found a way through the hospitals to ensure the continuation of our substance use disorder programs through the governor's commission.
I am so sorry to cut you off, but we've got to wrap it up. I really appreciate you coming, Commissioner Myers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura, for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.